Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm here for a second time with Dr. Bernard Register. He's professor of philosophy at Brown University. So, in our previous interview, we talked about his book, The Affirmation of Life, Nietzsche on Overcoming Nihilism, and I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. And today we're talking about another one of his books, The Will to Nothingness, an essay on Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morality. So, Dr. Register, welcome back to the show. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine, Ricardo.
So, to start our conversation with, what is basically the premise of On the Genealogy of Morality by Nietzsche?
Well, the genealogy of morality is unlike most of other Nietzsche's books insofar as it seems to have a very determinate focus, which is a critical examination of Christian morality as which is the moral outlook that started with Christianity, but that then is the basic inspiration for the modern secular variants of it in the Enlightenment, especially the morality of human rights, for example. I mean, any a moral outlook that basically considers that each and every human being possesses an equal moral standing and as such is entitled to basic respect and consideration. Now, despite its tight focus and its seeming systematic shape, the book is still created a great deal of puzzlement. So there's a Bernard Williams, for example, famously described it as a book that, on the one hand, seems to be hitting on something with great exactitude, but on the other, also remains infuriatingly vague. These are his words. So the purpose of my book was to try to understand what kind of argument, especially critical argument, Nietzsche develops against Christian morality. I mean, Nietzsche is famous for attacking Christian morality for calling it into question, but there remains a great deal of controversy and puzzlement as to what exactly he finds objectionable about it.
And what does it mean to call the genealogy of morality a form of epistemic debunking? What does that mean exactly?
Well, so the most well, one of the most puzzling aspects of Nietzsche's project in that book is that he claims to be able to derive normative conclusions about Christian morality from a historical investigation into its origin and development, a genealogy of it, so to speak. And philosophers have long puzzled over how that argument could work. I mean, so people worried that Nietzsche was committing a famous fallacy known as the genetic fallacy, which is the idea that you could impugn the truth of a statement by looking at the way the statement came about. So obviously that's a fallacy, but philosophers have since then reconsidered genealogical arguments, and one of the most influential forms that argument has been given is the form of epistemic debunking. So the idea is that you cannot show that a belief is false by examining the way in which the belief came about, but you can raise questions about whether the agent who holds the belief, a belief that is being formed in this particular way, is actually justified in holding the belief. That's what's known as epistemic debunking. So if you find that a belief has a certain kind of history, that, for example, it came about through the operation of mechanisms and processes that are not epistemically reliable, that are not the kinds of things that usually track the truth about the world, then it gives you a reason to reduce the confidence that you place in the belief. So that's one form of debunk. That's one form of one way of interpreting genealogical arguments that has been attributed to Nietzsche. I don't think, as you know, I don't think ultimately this is what Nietzsche takes his critique of morality to consist of. He doesn't simply try to show that people who subscribe to Christian morality, in fact, are on thin epistemic ground when they do so.
And when it comes to the approach Nietzsche uses in this book to tackle the genealogy of morality, would you say it is a naturalistic one?
Well, it's naturalistic in the sense that he tries to avoid any kind, in his explanation of what morality is, how it came about, and so on and so forth, he tries to avoid any kind of reference to factors that are not part of nature, that are not the kinds of factors that could be observed, recorded, documented by the natural sciences, whereby natural sciences that includes what we would call the social sciences, like psychology, for example. And so in that respect, his approach is in fact naturalistic. So he gives an explanation of how morality came about that doesn't involve the operation of entities such as God, that doesn't involve our possession of special properties like freedom of will, that doesn't involve positing normative facts or entities that could not be observed and known by the use of the methods of natural sciences, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And what does functionality mean in the context of morality?
Well, so my approach to the genealogical explanation of certain judgments is differs from the epistemic approach that you mentioned earlier, right? So Nietzsche, for the people who hold the epistemic view, Nietzsche is in the business of calling into question whether our moral beliefs, we have reasons to take our moral beliefs to be true or not. But in fact, Nietzsche on a number of occasions deny that what's important about beliefs in general, but moral beliefs in particular, is whether or not they are true. As he famously says, what's new about my approach is that whether a judgment is true is not what's important. You know, mm-hmm. What is important in his view is what it does to the individual who holds the belief to hold that belief. What kind of a functional benefit that person or the group to which that person belongs might derive from holding that particular belief. So the issue when you look at a moral belief for Nietzsche, like, for example, it is good to help the needy, the issue is not whether or not the belief is true, whether it tracks certain normative objective facts about the value or the rightness of helping the needy. The question is whether it is useful for individuals to hold and govern their lives by the light of such beliefs. So that's what he means by, that's what I mean by a functional approach. Mm-hmm. And so Nietzsche's ultimate claim is that while Christian moral beliefs have a kind of a functionality, that functionality is somehow defective. That's the claim that I want to make at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And how does Nietzsche approach moralities psychologically?
Well, so he famously says he doesn't say so directly in the genealogy of morality, but he says so in the book that he wrote right before, which is Beyond Good and Evil, and then he says it again in books that directly follow the genealogy of morality, such as, for example, The Twilight of the Idols. He famously says that moralities in general are a sign language of affects. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, a big discussion in the scholarly literature as to what exactly he means by this. Now, the standard view is that Nietzsche simply is advocating here a kind of sentimentalism about value. And sentimentalism about value is, it has several dimensions, but basically it's the idea that when I make a moral judgment, such as helping the needy is right, I express a sentiment that I have towards neediness or towards the act of helping the needy. So a sentiment of aversion towards neediness and a sentiment of inclination towards the act of helping the needy and relieving them of their suffering. So that's a standard view. Now, I argue, and we cannot go into the detail because there's some technical details involved here, but I argue that this cannot possibly be by what Nietzsche has in mind when he says that moralities are a sign language of the affects, if only because the affects that are supposed to explain the moral judgments do not connect, especially in Nietzsche's particular examples, with one another in the way that they should if he were just an ordinary sentimentalist about moral judgments. By the way, that sentimentalism about moral judgment is a view that was fairly well known, at least in British philosophy from the 17th and 18th century. And so if Nietzsche simply were borrowing their views, you would have expected him to at least acknowledge as much. But he doesn't. And it's because I think that the connection that he thinks, that he takes there to be between moral judgments and affective states is not an expressive relation, as it would have to be in sentimentalism, but a functional relation. The idea being that in his view, moral judgments can be understood in terms of the particular role they play in the affective lives of the agents who hold those judgments and live by them. For example, in terms of the whatever affective benefits holding those judgments might have for them. Their benefits, for example, in fulfilling certain affective needs they may have.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Nietzsche in his philosophy talks a lot about one particular kind of affect that he names ressentiment. So what is the role that ressentiment plays in the way he understands morality?
Yeah. Well, so the concept of ressentiment plays a very prominent role in the genus of morality. Nietzsche doesn't talk much about it before he writes that book, but the concept itself is probably present because he clearly seems it's a bit mysterious exactly how these two things relate, but clearly thinks that ressentiment is connected to what he calls revengefulness, that ressentiment is the motivational state that the emotional state that motivates revenge, and he talks about revengefulness from his earlier works on, but he introduces the concept of ressentiment specifically in the genus of morality, and it's been a bit of it's an ongoing question exactly what he means by this. Mm-hmm. So the concept of ressentiment is a French word that Nietzsche uses deliberately because there are German terms that are in the vicinity of what ressentiment means, like the word Groll, for example. But I think, and my German native German-speaking friends tell me so, that it doesn't quite capture the meaning of what in English we call resentment. So ressentiment is the French word that translates the English resentment. Now, the problem with claiming that Nietzsche, when he talks about ressentiment, has in mind what we in English mean resentment, is that in English, resentment has taken on a very strong moral connotation. So resentment is your response to the fact that you have been wronged, to the fact that you're the victim of an injustice, for example. Right. But it can be what Nietzsche has in mind precisely because he takes the affect of ressentiment to explain why we came up with moral values and moral judgments in the first place. So it cannot be ressentiment, resentment, because resentment presupposes that we already have those beliefs and values. So my rough sense is that ressentiment captures what we in English means resentment, but what we sometimes mean by resentment when we think of it as a non-moral emotion. So John Stuart Mill, for example, distinguishes between what he calls moral resentment, which is resentment when it is a response to injustice or wrongs, from natural resentment, which he associates, for example, with revenge. Now, he doesn't say much about what it is, And one of the questions for me in the book was to try to understand, what ressentiment is about, what it is responsive to, why it motivates revenge, and so on and so forth. And so the basic idea is that ressentiment for Nietzsche is linked to what he calls the will to power, when you understand the will to power as a kind of psychological state, a motivational state, you know, like a desire or an inclination or a drive towards power. But where power is to be understood in very specific ways, or it's not to be understood in the way in which it's usually understood. I mean, when you think about power, you think about control, you think about dominance and things of that mm-hmm. nature. But what Nietzsche means by power is more specific than that. And the reason is that control and dominance are things that typically you don't want for their own sake. They are things that you want for the sake of what they allow you to do. So my having control over a piece of territory or over the people, you know, allow me to make sure that they do my bidding. Same with dominance. But Nietzsche clearly seems to think that power is something that we want for its own sake, something that's the object of an intrinsic desire, to use that terminology. And so what you need is an understanding of power that makes it intelligible that this is something that you could want for its own sake. And so the idea that I have, and it draws on some of the metaphors that Nietzsche uses in his discussion of power, is that power is the fact of having your presence in the world make a causal difference in it. It's the idea of making your mark on the world, or making the world reflect your presence in it, where your presence in it is your presence under a specific description. So, mm-hmm. for example, in the case of human beings, your presence as an agent with a will, particular values, particular aspirations, and so on and so forth.
So at a certain point there, you mentioned revengefulness. So, and Nietzsche in his book talks about Christianity or Christian morality as an act of revenge. What does that mean exactly?
Ah, that's the $64,000 question. that's really the most arresting claim of the book. I mean, that Christian morality, the invention of Christian morality, is an act of revenge. And it's puzzling in all kinds of ways, right? It's puzzling in the first instance because when you think about revenge in the paradigmatic cases, you think about my wanting to make somebody suffer because they have made me suffer. You know, think about revenge as violent retaliation of some kind. Mm-hmm. But the invention of Christian morality is not a violent retaliation. It's basically the devising of a new moral outlook. So it's very hard to say to begin with how this, the invention of certain values, could count as revenge in the first place. Yeah. So that already shows that when he thinks about revenge, Nietzsche must have a fairly capacious understanding of it. And in fact, if you start scoring his works for instances in which he uses the concept of revenge, you realize that he takes the concept of revenge to have a very broad meaning. So for example, acts of gratitude can be acts of revenge for him. Acts of forgiveness, Christian forgiveness, he describes explicitly in Genesis, can be an act of revenge. Acts of beneficence can be acts of revenge. And then he also argues that you can take revenge not just against other people, but you can take revenge against impersonal entities like life. So in the third essay of the genealogy, he says that the invention of asceticism was an act of revenge against life. You can take revenge against time. You can take revenge against reality for Nietzsche. So it's very, very puzzling, right? Mm-hmm. So my thought here, my driving thought, and by the way, I'm writing a new book about revenge just in order to clarify those issues at the moment. But my driving thought is that, so ressentiment is the response that you have when your power, the sense that your presence in the world is doesn't make a difference in it, or doesn't make in it the difference that you expect, is challenged, is called into question, is called into doubt. Okay, so ressentiment is, so to speak, a fight response against doubts raised about your power. So, for example, when somebody treats you as if you're nothing, when they make you suffer, they disregard your will and so on and so forth, that's a paradigmatic instance in which you're liable to feel or to be made to feel impotent. And one of the responses that you can have, of course, is shame, which is when you withdraw, when you submit, when you comply. Or you can have, which is a flight response, or you can have a fight response, which is to respond and to try to assert your power. For example, by making suffer the person who has made you suffer, by imposing your will upon theirs after they have imposed their will upon yours. Okay, so revenge is the act whereby you attempt to restore your power in that sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is, well, how could the invention of new values constitute an act of revenge for Nietzsche, right? Well, so the idea is this, right? There are two elements to power, right? So power is, you want your presence in the world to make a difference in it. But the second element is that you want your presence in the world under a certain description, okay? So what I am is an agent with a certain kind of will. With my will, in this case for Nietzsche, is the repository of my values, my aspiration, what I consider to be important. So what it is for me to have power, or to feel as though I have power, is that I'm able to make it so that the world around me reflect my presence in it, for example, by realizing my values, you know. And I'm liable then to feel as though I am important if my will, my values, and my pursuit of them, my agency, make no difference in that world. So the idea is that our Christianity, for Nietzsche, or at least Christian morality, is an act of revenge for people whose will has made no difference in the world, but they realize that they have no option in order to become able to make a difference in the world other than by altering the contents of their will, by altering the description under which they want to make a difference in the world. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that, well, look, if you can't bend the world to your will, maybe you can change your will so that whatever it is that you can do will count as bending the world to your will. So changing your values is like changing what is going to count as power for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. And in this case, if the motivation is to restore your feeling of power, to make it the case again that you can feel as though your presence in the world makes a difference in it, then the invention of Christian morality is an act of revenge.
And so what would be the goals of revenge in Christian morality? Does it have any specific goals or not?
Well, okay, so a big question when you think about revenge in general is precisely the question of what the goal of revenge is, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so again, the paradigmatic instance is that you cause me to suffer, and my revenge, my retaliation is to make you suffer because you made me suffer. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, well, but what do I get out of this? Okay, so you made me suffer and I made you suffer in return. I retaliate. What's the purpose of my retaliation? What do I accomplish with that retaliation? What do I achieve? Or what is my aim in retaliating? What am I trying to achieve when I retaliate? So that's a difficult question. And that question, I think, has motivated the view that many philosophers take up to this day, which consists in treating revenge as a kind of punishment. So revenge is basically punishment, but in circumstances where there are no institutions of justice capable of meting out the punishment, so that the individual, him or herself, has, as we say, to take the law into his own hands or into her own hands. Okay, so revenge in this way, to use Francis Bacon's famous phrase, is wild justice. It's justice, it aims at justice, but in conditions, in wild conditions or conditions of wilderness. Okay, mm-hmm. So, you know, the American Western movies, for example, is almost always about revenge. Mm-hmm. But in this case, you can say that this revenge is wild justice, because what they try to achieve is justice, but under conditions of wilderness where there are no institutions. There's no effective police institution. There's no system of justice. And the individual has to then, you know, be the judge and the executioner, him or herself. Now, again, if revenge aimed at justice for Nietzsche, then it would presuppose the morality that he thinks is created by revenge. So Nietzsche must have an understanding of revenge which is not moral or not moralized in that way. And in fact, there are some philosophers who have argued that revenge does not aim at justice, that if you make me suffer, when I take revenge, I don't construe you're making me suffer as a wrong or as an injustice, and then my retaliation would be a form of punishment. Something else is going on. But then that's the mystery. What else is going on? If when I retaliate against you for having made me suffer, I'm not, my aim is not to punish you. My aim is not, for example, to deter you from doing something wrong. My aim is not to make sure you don't get away with it, that you get what you deserve. My aim must be something else. And the question is, well, what is the aim of revenge? And my idea is that the aim of revenge, again, is, you know, power in the specific sense in which I understand it. It's to restore in yourself the sense that your presence in the world makes a difference in it. And the idea, the reason why this is non-moral is because this need for power is a very fundamental, very basic psychological need, which is connected, in my view, I mean, I can try to explain this to you, but it's connected with the importance it's connected with our feeling of existence, our sense that we are, as we say in Hungary, we are somebody. You know, some people feel I'm a nobody. And what it usually means is that when they feel like they are nobodies, is because they feel that their presence in the world makes no difference in it. They don't accomplish anything. They go unnoticed. They are invisible to others, and so on and so forth. And sometimes in those circumstances, they will react revengefully. They will want to do something that changes their sense of themselves as nobodies. They will make them feel like they are somebody. So I think that the aim of revenge, when it's considered, you know, a non-moral impulse, is this. It's what Nietzsche calls power.
So earlier we've talked about functionality. Would you say that Christian morality or the Christian moral outlook is itself functional?
Well, yes. So the function, so ressentiment is an affective state. You know, remember that Nietzsche claims, I mean, the sort of the view of moral belief or morality or moral judgment that that underlies Nietzsche's project in the genealogy is this idea that moralities are sign language of affects, that moral judgments or systems of moral judgments, excuse me, my dog is making some noise there.
No worries.
So moralities and moral judgments are not expressions of affects, but they are causally related to those affects. Underlying Nietzsche's approach to Christian morality in the genealogy of morality is the idea that moral judgments, moral beliefs, moral concepts have a certain kind of a functional role to play in the affective emotional economy of agents. Okay, so my holding a certain belief like helping the needy is good, or my holding a certain conception of what justice is, and so on and so forth, all of these things can be understood as being in some sense designed to play a certain kind of role in my emotional economy, to satisfy certain emotional needs. Now the question is, well, what is the emotional need that's being satisfied by Christian morality? And according to Nietzsche, the emotional need that's being satisfied is the emotional need that's expressed or enshrined in the affect of ressentiment. It's the need to feel as though your presence in the world makes a difference in it. And again, your presence in the world under a certain description. Okay. So, and there are various ways in which it does that, right? So one of the chief characteristics of Christian morality is this notion that every single human being, regardless of origin, regardless of circumstance, it has moral status and as such is entitled to respect and consideration. Mm-hmm. And that's a way in which so if you believe that, then it dispenses you, in order to feel as though your presence in the world can make a difference, and it dispenses you from having to do anything, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you're entitled to the kind of respect and recognition or notice from others in virtue of being who you are, not in virtue of your being able to do something. So if you live in a culture where your status is linked to your, for example, achievement, such as, for example, the honor cultures of ancient Rome, where your moral status, your honor was linked to your political and martial prowess, for example. Mm-hmm. Then, in order to have your presence in the world make a difference in it, in order to have to enjoy notice and recognition, you have to do certain things. But of course, if you're not capable, if you don't have the capacities, for example, to handle weapons, to be good at fighting and so on and so forth, then you risk, you know, being a nobody, literally. So one of the ways in which you can begin to change this, it's not sufficient, but one of the ways in which you can begin to change this is by changing values and by changing what counts as worthy of recognition, for example.
And so could you tell us now about the concepts of slave morality and master morality as Nietzsche understood them and as Nietzsche used them, and how do they apply to an understanding of Christian morality from his own perspective?
Yeah, so again, those concepts are very loose in Nietzsche, and they connect to various things. I think that the dominant strain in distinguishing between these two moral outlooks for Nietzsche has to do with the concept of equality. So he famously describes master moralities as those moralities in which, as he puts it, there's a difference in value between human being and human being. Not everybody is equal. Not everybody is the same. Some people deserve more consideration, more recognition, more notice than others. Or some people are entitled to certain privileges to which others are not. Okay. So what he clearly is referring to is, well, I mean, I'm no historian of morality, but I would imagine that many, many moral outlooks prior to Christianity were probably inegalitarian moral outlooks, for example, slavery was widespread. Slavery was considered completely normal. And of course, if you think that some people can be the slaves of other people, you don't think that every human being, by virtue of being a human being, has equal worth. Okay. So the big innovation of Christian morality for Nietzsche is precisely this idea that of equality, the idea that all human beings have equal worth, which entitles them to respect and consideration, maybe passion and so on and so forth. And that goes straight back to the idea that every human being is a child of God, and as such, deserves a kind of standing. So I think that's the crucial thing. There are, if you look closely, there are other distinctions that you can draw. So for example, I sometimes suspect that the distinction between a master morality outlook and a slave morality outlook is the distinction that we draw today, or that sociologists draw today, between what's called an honor culture and a dignity culture.
Mm-hmm.
Where, and you know, sometimes honor cultures are hierarchical cultures, they are inegalitarian cultures, and whereas dignity cultures are egalitarian cultures. But there's other distinctions between honor and dignity. For example, dignity cultures are cultures in which you don't have to do anything in order to be to have status or standing and to deserve a certain kind of, to have certain rights and certain prerogatives. Whereas in honor cultures, you have to do something, you know. So honor, unlike dignity, is something that can be lost. Dignity, I mean, you can behave in any way you want. You can behave in an undignified manner. It's not going to change the fact that you have dignity simply by virtue of being a person. But if you behave dishonorably, you lose your honor. So there are other distinctions like that that might operate in the background of what Nietzsche has in mind, but it's not easy to tell. So,
where do the ideas of good and evil come from, according to Nietzsche?
Well, so there was, there is a distinction between good and bad that predates the invention of Christian morality, right? So in master moralities, you know, to be good is to be like the master, and to be bad is to be like, you know, everybody else who's not the master. Yeah. So what's distinctive about Christian morality is the switch from that conceptual pairing, good, bad, to good, evil. Mm-hmm. So the question is, well, what exactly is the difference? Well, the one chief difference, there are several, but one chief difference, I think, has to do with the importance in the application of the concept of moral evil of the idea of a free will. So bad in the context of Christian morality simply refers to what's vile, what's ignoble, what's low, and so on and so forth, and whether you're vile, whether you're ignoble, is unrelated to whether or not you are acting freely, for example. Okay. By contrast, when you describe, at least in a strict sense, when you describe an action as morally evil, it is essential that you suppose that the person who perpetrated that action did so freely. Because if the action was an accident, then it may be evil in some sense. It may, because it had bad consequences, for example, but it's not morally evil. Okay, it's only if you did something that is morally wrong on purpose, deliberately, mm-hmm. intentionally, if you did it freely, that you can be, and therefore that you can be held responsible for it, that the action counts as morally evil. So that's one important distinction that Nietzsche draws. He draws also these a lot murkier distinctions between good, bad, and good, evil. And so, for example, one of the things that he says is that the pair good, evil, unlike the pair good, bad, begins with an act of negation. Begins with the invention of evil. So it's as if you first describe some people or some types of action as evil, and then as an afterthought, what's not like that you characterize as good. Whereas in so-called master moralities, you start out by asserting something as good, and then as an afterthought, what's not like that is bad. Exactly what Nietzsche means by this, and he makes a bit of a big deal out of this way of carving the distinction in the genealogy, is a bit unclear. I have some thoughts about this in the book, but I'm not absolutely certain that I have quite understood. There's something interesting going on there, but it's there are various ways in which you can understand it.
Fair enough. And what would you say is the role that things like guilt and punishment play in Nietzsche's account of the genealogy of morality, and perhaps more specifically in Christian morality?
Well, that's a complicated business. So the genealogy of morality is divided into three essays. In the first essay, this is where he talks most about ressentiment and the invention of good and evil and things of that nature. And then in the second and the third essay, the notions of guilt and punishment figure prominently. I mean, even in the third essay, which is ostensibly about the invention of ascetic ideals, there he says that the central ascetic practice consists in interpreting all of your suffering, as he puts it, under the perspective of guilt. That is, it's consists in seeing every piece of misfortunes that befalls you, every suffering you have to endure, you have to interpret it as punishment for your sins, so to speak. So basically, the third essay really draws very heavily on what he does on the second essay. So the two essays together form a kind of a conceptual whole there. So what's the importance of all of this? Well, that took me some time to try to figure out, right? So one thought that I pursued here is that the concept of guilt and the concept of responsibility that's tied up to it may be understood in the context of this, the attempt to try to satisfy your need for power, the sense that you have effectiveness as an agent in sort of a living and making the world reflect your values or your aspirations. and so the idea is this, right? The idea is that if you do something that falls short of your values, you could feel ashamed. But if you feel ashamed, the concept of shame is a notoriously difficult concept, but one way to distinguish between shame and guilt is this, right? When you feel ashamed because you have failed to live up to your own values, usually what that means is that you tried, but you didn't have what it takes. So your agency lacked effectiveness, you lacked power in that sense. And that's very, very difficult to accept. Whereas if you feel simply guilty, then it's true that you fail to live up to your own values. You fail to realize them in the way you live, but you could have done otherwise. You had the power to do it. So in this way, feeling guilty can be a defense against the much more emotionally damaging feeling of shame. Okay. So by inventing the concept of guilt and then giving it very broad application, you can see that Christian morality plays a role in this, or has the function of, as it were, restoring or buttressing the feeling of power of people in whom that feeling is under threat. Okay, so that's the first thought. The second thought, to come to the question of punishment now, the second thought has to do with which comes with a puzzle. So the second essay is ostensibly devoted to a genealogy of the feelings of guilt. But the problem is that in the first essay, Nietzsche already has given us a genealogy of guilt. You know, by giving us a genealogy of what are the norms of guilt, I mean the norms that you have to violate in order to feel guilty, and by giving us a genealogy of freedom of will. Because to feel guilty, you have to feel as though you're responsible for violating certain norms. Now, Nietzsche gives us, in the first essay, a genealogy of the freedom of will that makes you responsible, and a genealogy of the norms, the violation of which would induce guilt. So it seems like he has not already given us a genealogy of guilt. So what is he doing then in the second essay that's different from the first? Well, in the second essay, what Nietzsche does is that he pursues a very different line about guilt. And the line that he pursues has to do with the association that even we draw between guilt and indebtedness. So we talk, for example, about being punished for our sins as a way of paying our debts. So there's a connection there, which in German is actually very strong, because the same word "schuld" can be translated as guilt and has indebtedness or debt in any event. So he's very interested in that connection. And the reason why he's interested in the connection is because he's interested in a particular way in which guilt and punishment can be related. So typically, when we think of punishment, I think we tend to think of it in retributive terms. Okay, so you did something wrong, I punish you, and my punishing you is retribution in the sense that all I'm trying to do is to get you what you deserve to make sure you don't get away with it. That's it. But if you think of punishment as retribution, it does not undo the guilt. You know, it doesn't wash away the guilt, so to speak. But, and this is especially true in Christianity, there's a way in which punishment can wash away the guilt. And then the question is, well, how could that be possible? Well, if you think about guilt as indebtedness, and you think of punishment as an alternative way of paying your debt, then you can see how punishment could wash away the guilt. And this is the line that Nietzsche explores in that second essay. You know, so sometimes you can fail to live up to your own values. And of course, that, you know, that shows that, you know, you maybe you don't have what it takes to live up to the values. It raises that question. Mm-hmm. But if it turns out that you can somehow demonstrate that you have the capacity to live up to those values, for example, by undergoing the kind of deprivation that living up to the values requires of you in the form of punishment or penance, then it reassures you with regard to your power. And I think that this is the line that Nietzsche is pursuing.
So before we get into the will to nothingness itself that gives title to your book, let me just ask you about another topic. So what are Nietzsche's thoughts on asceticism?
So one of the striking features of Christian morality and even the secular variants of Christian morality that were developed in the Enlightenment, and they're the roughly defined moral outlook with which we, at least in the Western world, live these days, is that to act morally is not necessarily good for you. Okay, to act morally, you may have to do things that are not in your best interest. You may have to you may have to do things that are going to harm you, that are going to be bad for you in that sense. It's a new idea. I mean, for the ancient Greeks, for example, it's very striking that the reasons to act in ways that they consider moral, to act virtuously, is that it's good for you. Okay, so in Aristotelian virtue ethics, it's like that. You know, why should I, you know, be good to my friends, for example? Mm-hmm. Why should I treat other people in the ways that I'm, you know, that the morality requires me to treat them? Not because it's good for you. That's the answer. Okay, yeah. It's not the case in modern morality. In modern morality, you know, morality requires me to do things that are going to go against my interests, that are going to be bad for me. And Nietzsche finds the origin of this in Christian morality. Okay, now, so there's a kind of a built-in asceticism in the modern moral outlook that grew out of Christian morality. Now, of course, in the modern moral outlook, that asceticism is fairly attenuated. Right? I mean, the modern moral outlook doesn't say, look, you should give up on your happiness. You should go against what's good for you. You should go against your well-being if you want in order to be moral. No, it says that, no, you can pursue your well-being. You can pursue your happiness, but only within the limits that are placed upon that pursuit by morality. So there might be occasions in your life where you have to choose between what's good for you and what's morally right. Okay, so that can happen. That's the extent of the asceticism in modern morality. Okay, there might be I mean, of course, in extreme circumstances, it may mean your death. I mean, sometimes morality requires you to sacrifice yourself, not just your own being, but your life for a moral cause of some kind.
Right.
There are many examples like this. But in Christian morality, the asceticism is not so attenuated. Okay, in Christian morality, you're being told that what it is to be moral, what it is to be good, is to turn your back on your prosperity, your well-being, your flourishing, at least as a member of the natural world. Okay, so what it is for me to be moral in the terms of Christian morality, as Nietzsche understands it, is to turn my back on the natural world completely and on myself as a member of the natural world. So I have to give up on what he calls in the genealogy physiological, which is another way in German to say natural well-being. So my well-being as an embodied individual with the kinds of needs, including psychological and emotional needs, that are characteristic of an embodied being. I have to turn my back on all of this. That's what asceticism is. That's the kind of asceticism that Nietzsche targets in the third essay of the genealogy.
So getting into the final topic of our conversation today, what is then the will to nothingness and where does it stem from?
Well, so the will to nothingness is a phrase that Nietzsche introduces in the final essay of the genealogy. He mentions it in the first section of the essay and then in the final concluding section of the essay, where, and he says in both cases that it's better to will nothingness than not to will at all. And so clearly what he has in mind is the role that the endorsement of Christian morality can play in warding off against nihilism, where nihilism is the condition of not willing, where what motivates not willing is the fact that it seems pointless to you to will anything, to go. And it can be pointless either because you can identify nothing worth willing, or even if you can identify something worth willing, as I argued in my first book, if you don't have what it takes to achieve what's worth willing, then what's the point of willing it anyway, if you can get there? And so he thinks that Christian morality, you know, is one of the functions of Christian morality is to stave off that kind of a nihilistic, what he calls suicidal nihilism. So to that extent, Christian morality is an instrument of self-preservation. But Christian morality does that in a way that's going to prove to be very costly. So it's trying to stave off nihilism, but in a way that eventually, you know, fails, is self-defeating in that way. And that's why I think he calls it a will to nothingness. So I don't think that what he means is that, you know, the Christians want nothingness as such. Yeah. But what they want, the way in which they go about willing, ends up being a will to nothingness, because it's a way of willing, it's a way of engaging in your life that turns out to sets yourself a kind of an objective that but does so in a way that proves to be self-defeating in the end of the day. And that's why it ends in nothingness anyway. You try to keep nothingness away, but in a way that makes it unavoidable for you.
So is this will to nothingness a moral outlook itself or not?
Well, so to say that the Christian moral outlook expresses a will to nothingness is basically the central critical claim that Nietzsche makes, right? So the Christian moral outlook has a certain function, but the way in which it fulfills that function proves to be self-defeating or self-undermining. So the function is, broadly speaking, to restore their feeling of power to people whose weakness has exposed them to it. But it does so in a way that by depleting the strength of that individual makes them in the long run unable to maintain that feeling of power, makes them unable to do the kinds of things that would make it the case that their presence in the world makes a difference in it. Which is why I argue that, it's especially true of the asceticism that Nietzsche advocates, that this asceticism turns out to be a Pyrrhic victory, because, if you believe that you can't achieve natural well-being, then repudiating natural well-being, claiming that it has no value, makes you has the benefit that you don't have to feel like you are impotent or incompetent for your failure to achieve that kind of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem is that if you want to continue subscribing to the ascetic ideal, you have to deprive yourself in ways that are going to weaken you even further, which is why Nietzsche says that the Christian morality, Christian asceticism in particular, addresses a sickness, the sickness that's caused by the weakness that makes it very difficult for you to make it the case that your presence in the world makes a difference in it.
Yeah.
It addresses that weakness. It addresses only the symptoms of the weakness, not the cause, the cause being the weakness. And in fact, what it does is that it further exacerbates the weakness instead of eliminating it, ensuring that in the long run, you will find yourself completely incapable of making it the case that your presence in the world makes a difference in it. So I use two analogies that might be helpful here. One is the analogy of a Pyrrhic victory. So Pyrrhus was this famous general who won victories, but at great cost to his army. So it's a victory, all right. He defeated the opposite army, but he came out of that defeat having no army himself. So that if he were to face another threat again, he would be unable to meet it. So if for a moment manages to do what he needs to do to establish security, to establish his power, but at the cost of being able to do it, you know, in the long run. So that's why it's a process that's ultimately self-undermining. The other analogy that I use, which is quite applicable actually, is an analogy with a particular way of understanding the phenomenon of anorexia at least in certain strains of psychoanalytic theory. So the anorexic gives up on the desire for food. They claim that feeding myself is not important. And it turns out that the motivation very often, it has to do with power and independence. You know, so there are going to be cases where the anorexic refuses to eat because, for example, their caregivers use the act of feeding them as an opportunity for them, the caregivers, to demonstrate to the anorexic, him or herself, that they have power over them, that the anorexic is dependent on them, and so on and so forth. So that the anorexic might decide that, well, if I want to assert my power and my independence, I have to give up on the desires that make me dependent, that make me powerless. And so you can see how, in some sense, they do, by disavowing those desires or by devaluing those desires, they do achieve a measure of power and independence, but you can also see what the cost is for it.
Mm-hmm. Great. So the book is again The Will to Nothingness, an essay on Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morality. I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. And Dr. Register, would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Well, I mean, the best place to go, such as it is probably the website of the philosophy department at Brown University, where I have a research page, which is always in need of updating and improvement. But I hope to be able to do this sometimes over the course of the summer.
Okay, great. So thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
The pleasure has been all mine, Ricardo. Thank you so much.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you liked it, please do not forget to like it, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you like more generally what I'm doing, please consider supporting the show on Patreon or PayPal. You have all of the links in the description of this interview. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Per-Erge Larsen, Jerry Mueller, Hans Frederick Sunde, Bernardo Seixas, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Visser, Adam Castle, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Henrik Alenia, John Connors, Philip Forbes Connolly, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Michael Stormer, Samuel Andreff, Francis Ford, Tiago Nunes, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Librant, João Linhares, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Weira, Tom Hummel, Sardis France, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londoño Correa, Yannick Punter, Adana Ruzmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavlo Stasevski, Nelek Bak, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hallman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yeagy, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Panos Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sonny Smith, John Wiseman, Morten Eklund, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnault, Luke Lowacki, Georgios Theofanos, Chris Williamson, Peter Olsen, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Eriksson, Charles Murray, Alex Shaw, Amaury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Holt Erigbund, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Gressy, Tom Roth, DRPMD, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Richard Bowen, Thomas Dobner, Luke Nissen, Chris Story, Manuel Oliveira, Kimberly Johnson, and Benjamin Galbart. A special thanks to my producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Tom Vanagdam, Bernard Hugney, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, John Carlo Montenegro, Robert Lewis and Al Nick Ortiz, and to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriana, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.